Then Bhrigu goes on to describe that here is that there's a time by which one should have taken up seriously the study of the Vedas. So the Brahmin by his 15th year, the Kshatriya by his 21st, and the Vaishya by the 23rd. And that if they haven't taken it up by this time, then they're considered fallen. Because the whole idea is that the Vedic culture is meant for understanding Brahman, meant for understanding what is, you know, the purpose of life. Like that Aryan means one who is elevating himself. So whatever the position, that one has to try to progress. So now if by this ages they haven't progressed, this means that they're not very serious. The qualification is not very great. So therefore they're considered not of good standard. Means if by this time they haven't had an interest, they don't have the qualification. Means it's been very liberal. You know, Brahmins till they're 15. Otherwise beyond that, then they start, beyond these ages, then they start to get more absorbed in the material energy. Means up to these times, then they may stay, you know, the youthful nature may remain. But beyond this, then it's like if they haven't gotten serious, then they're not going to get serious. So it's quite liberal, but at the same time as the purpose is to get to this advanced platform. So then, and it says, therefore, if there is someone who is very serious about this Vedic culture, then they should not make any kind of alliance with such people. The someone who is so unqualified that they haven't been able to come up to the standard of taking, you know, seriously the study of the spiritual life, then they should not make any connection to them through study, trying to teach them, or through, how you say, marriage. So, of course, we have to understand that this is talking about those who are born into the Vedic culture. It means those who are not, then that's another thing. And when we deal with the second, the Pancharatrika initiation, then that is like a new birth. So then in that case, one can then, of course, take up the study. So when we actually take up serious interest, that is the time. The main point is being given here by their observation. Those who have grown up in the culture, know about the culture, but don't take it seriously, then by this age, then basically they're not going to get serious. But we have to understand that this is specifically for just the, progress within these varnas and ashrams very nicely. Spiritual life is another thing. If one takes spiritual life seriously, then naturally these things, they come automatic. It means if one has taken the spiritual life and one has taken up the practice of the Pancharatrika lifestyle, then the Vedic lifestyle, being supportive of that, becomes a very natural thing for one to do. So that's not a problem. But what it's trying to point out is the seriousness that if one wants to develop properly, then one has to take it up seriously as soon as possible. One should not waste one's time. Then, in the tradition here, then the students in the Gurukul, then they would have different kinds what they would wear. Means the upper cloth of the Brahmin would be from the black antelope, the black buck. Then the girdle that they would wear, in other words, the string on which they would hang their kopans, that would be made out of munja grass. And the lower cloth then would be made out of cotton. And then for the Kshatriyas, they would wear a spotted deer. They would use a bowstring for their girdle. And for cloth, they would use... I think it's flax. It's not mentioning it here. And for the Vaishya, they would wear the skins from the he-goats. They would use hempen threads for their girdle, and they would use woolen threads for their Brahmin thread. Then the staff, the Brahmacharis carry a staff, because when they go, when you travel, you need to keep away the... You know, sometimes for walking, and, you know, you always run into animals you wish you hadn't run into, you know, some dogs or this or that, and monkeys. So the stick always creates some sense of respect from these animals. Or you're going down the road and some cows come and they decide that the road belongs to them, and they're not willing to give you any space on the road. Or especially buffaloes. Buffaloes like to do that. So the stick comes in handy. The deer skin they can use for sleeping on, because they wouldn't keep bedding in that. They would just sleep on the floor. So they can sleep on the deer skin. We see the Pandavas when they were in exile, when they were hiding as Brahmins, then they were using the deer skins, so that when Draupadi's family means... into this assembly of kings, even Krishna was there, and so many kings of the world were there. And then Draupadi was very attractive. There was I forget what the name of the king was. It's may have been the one, what was it? Maybe it's Bhagadatta. The one whose eyelids were, he had to hold them up with bowstrings, you know, tied to his eyelashes, because he was so old, his eyelids would fall shut. They were just so loose. But he was on the battlefield. He's so powerful. So he came, I think he was a grandfather at the time, so he came with his, you know, wives and that, and his sons and that, and the idea was is his sons, or I'm not even sure it was his sons or the grandsons, were, you know, coming to Vai in the Swayamvar. But then, you know, they came, and because when they have these programs, they have a big arena, and every king has his own place where he can sit, their own, like, you know, like separate area, you know, sectioned off area that he, his family members, his servants, his bodyguards, like that. So each one is taken care of very nicely, like bandstand, like that on the side. So when he came and sat down, and, you know, everyone's sitting and ready, and they're cutting their Kshatriya profiles and, you know, everything like that. And then when Draupadi came out onto the balcony with her father, then, because she was so attractive, then even this grandfather, he got up, picked up his bow, and he walked down into the assembly that he was one of the ones for, you know, in the running, you know, because it was then they'd all come out, and then she'd get to see, and then they would try to shoot the arrow, you know, through the wheel into the fish's eye. So none of them did it. Then after everyone had failed, then Arjuna then stepped forward, dressed as a Brahmin. You know, so all these Kshatriyas couldn't do it. And Drupad, then he had made this system just because he knew the only one that could do it is Arjuna. Right? And they wouldn't let, Karna would be the only other one who could do it, but Karna wouldn't be allowed because he wasn't a Kshatriya. I don't think he had made his appearance at that time. I think he appeared later on the scene. So then, none came forward, and so Drupad was very upset. And then this Brahmin comes forward, and while everybody's bewildered, he just steps up, looks in the water, and shoots the eye of the fish, and then takes Draupadi. And then, you know, it's kind of like one of those things, everybody's kind of stunned. stunned one, nobody did it. All the Kshatriyas came forward, no one did, so they don't know what to do, because Swayamvara, somebody's supposed to win, you know. And then after that, then suddenly this Brahmin comes forward, and everyone's just kind of bewildered, what's this Brahmin, you know. And he comes forward, they don't expect the Brahmin to be able to, and then he shoots and he wins. And so then it hasn't quite registered, and then next thing they know is he's walking off with a girl. And then they all kind of like come to their senses. And then Bhima is standing there to take care of any Kshatriyas that don't somehow or another agree with the goings on. So that starts a whole riot, you know. And then in this way they all, the Pandavas all escape. So the Drupad's thinking, what's going on? You know, I was expecting to marry my daughter to Arjuna, and instead, you know, they took taken by some Brahmins, and you know, which Brahmins are these? We never heard of them, and that they're so expert in martial arts, and they got a brother like Bhima, you know, he's this big, huge gorilla. And they're thinking, what's going on? So he sends some spies to find out, and then he sees that these Brahmins, you know, they come in, they put down their deer skins, they all lay down, you know, they all lay down in a line, and right next to each other. And then Draupadi, because she's ended up marrying all of them, idea was that she'd marry Arjuna. But then when they came back, you know, every day they go out begging. So they'd gone out begging, and while they were out begging, they attended the Swayamvara. And every day they bring back something, and then they bring it to Kunti, their mother, and then she says, okay, distribute it amongst all of you. So today she was busy doing something, and then they came and says, oh, look what we brought while we were out. And she said, well, you know, you just share it amongst yourself equally. You know, and then they didn't know what to do, you know, because they were talking about Draupadi, not about some rice and dal they just begged. So then, because she had said it, you know, and the Kshatriyas, the word is important, so therefore that was, she ended up marrying all of them. So then they would all lay down in a line on their deer skins, and then she would lay down at their feet. You know, means they would all be facing east, and she would lay down facing south at their feet. And then, so the spies come and saw all this, and, you know, they look like Brahmins, they're laying on the floor on the deer skins like Brahmins, everything's like Brahmins, but they're not talking Shastra. You know, they're sitting talking about this and that and all different things, techniques of warfare and all these kind of things. They go back to Drupad, you know, what's going on, you know. So in this way, then Drupad calls them and tests them and finds out that actually they're Kshatriyas and, you know, that was Arjuna and, you know, all these different things. And so it all worked out very nicely. But you could see is they would use the deer skin like this for laying down. Another thing they would use it is when it would rain. And they would hold it over the head or over the back. So if it rained, then it would, the deer skins are waterproof. So then there would be no problem. And the skin is pure. You need to put it in the sun to purify it. So it would use that like that. The belt then is for holding the kopans. It would hold their underwear with that. And these different things would then bring out these different aspects. You know, the munja grass, or if you don't have munja, then you can use kusa. Like that. The whole thing is wound and it goes around three times. And then it's tied in a knot. So then it also protects, specifically for protecting one's chastity. That is the purpose of the belt. Then they have their staff. Brahmana will use bilva or, what is it, palashes, jackfruit. The Kshatriya will use vata, which is a kind of banyan tree. And the Kshatriya was pilu or udumbura. Pilu are those trees that grow in Vrindavan, the little trees that always bend over like that. So the staff should be straight, should look very nice, it should look very good, it shouldn't look terrible. It means people see it, it's attractive, it shouldn't look terrifying. It's not something for war, so it should look pleasant. So when the brahmachari walks with it, no one feels afraid of him. Like that. It should have nice bark and it shouldn't be bent. Because if you have a stick and it's not straight, you can bend it by fire. So that is done. Then then they, what do you call it? The Brahmins will take up to the hairline. Then the Kshatriya is up to the eyebrows, and the Vaishya is up to the tip of the nose. So like this, you could also tell the nature of the student by how he was dressed. They all would wear wear skins, and the Brahmin underwear and the Brahmin threads like that, because they were made out of something different and their staves were different, then you could tell what is the nature of the student. Then having these are all what is arranged, then through the Upanayanam ceremony they receive all these things. The staff, the girdle represents the earth like that, because the earth protects one's chastity. Then the deer skin is the sun, and I think the staff is knowledge. So with these things, then the brahmachari, he progresses in life. He follows brahmacharya. He studies the knowledge by worshiping the Lord and his energies, the teachers, like this. So out of with respect, he gains knowledge in maintaining chastity. So after this ceremony is complete, then he, at the end of the ceremony, then he begs. So this is also an interesting thing, how they use the different skins, is that the formula of her begging is bhavati bhiksham dehi. So bhavati means, oh good woman, you know, you approach the ladies at the house, when you go to door in the day, many times it's just the ladies there. If it's a man, then it's bhavan. But bhavati bhiksham dehi. Bhavati bhiksham is alms, dehi, please give. So now a Brahmin will say, bhavati bhiksham dehi. So the respect to the person is offered first. Then what is the business at hand is begging. And dehi is please give, is what the other person is what is the completes the connection. You've approached the person respectfully, you've told what it is that you are, what is the business, and then what is their part in the whole thing, the connection, the relationship. So the Kshatriyas then will say, Bhiksham Dehi Bhavati. They will, for the Brahmins, it's the person, respect. For the Kshatriya, then it's the work, practical. Means we're coming for Bhiksham, you're giving, and then he offers respect to the person. And for the Vaishya, then they will say, Dehi Bhavati Bhiksham. Because for them, the gain is the most important. So that is said first. So it's interesting, just by nature also, is what is the prominent feature, you know, like that. Then after having begged, then he goes around and that, then he gives this to the teacher, and then the teacher then asks him that, you know, this is what he will take. Then he eats this. Yeah. So this is then, now he is second, twice initiated. This is the initiation ceremony, or the Vedic, the Upanayanam. And then they will continue this throughout their, the begging and eating after they've given things to the teacher. Whole idea is that when they're at the home, they're dependent upon the parents. And the place to stay, what they will eat, how they will dress, that is all supplied by the parents. And the parents also take on the reactions to the immature child. He's up to the age of 16, the reactions go to the parents. Is it 16, then they're adult. So then here, but when you go to the Gurukul, then the teacher, he supplies the clothes, the place to stay, and the food. So the whole idea is that one must be, at the time of when one's young, one has to be dependent upon the parents. And from them he gains all his preliminary knowledge, his preliminary understanding. Like we see that in, which book is that? Is it a Krishna book? Where Prabhupada, in the offering, he offers respects to his father, who then trained him in the, you know, fundamentals of Krishna consciousness, which were then later then firmly established by Spirit Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So this is the principle, is that the parents then train one in the basic, you know, the culture, etiquette, especially moral standards, a tendency towards religious behavior, and in the basics of the Krishna conscious philosophy and lifestyle. Then when one gets older, one goes to the school, and then the teacher then takes those and refines them. He makes them conscious. The parents may have been able to make them somewhat conscious, but generally they're unconscious. This, they do them, they do that they're told to do, they do. They follow because of the affection for the parents, the respect for the parents, and they're doing these things. But they don't exactly know why. So, or it's not fully understood and well practiced. So that the teacher then takes that and makes that well practiced, well understood, and, you know, it means the consciously understood, and takes it to the point where now they'll be able to train and lead others. So there, then, that's what the teacher does. He provides, and then while they're with the teacher is the one who's taking the reactions, not the parents. Like that. And then when he grows up and matures, then as he works under his authorities then take a portion to that degree of how much the surrender is, you know, either in fruits or in just activities, then that much reactions are accepted. So this is also an important aspect to understand in the whole process. Many times, it's interesting, now they're getting all worried about only Prabhupada can take reactions, but, you know, understanding your mother and father are taking reactions, you know, whether they're spiritual or not. Then the teacher's taking, and then one's authorities are taking, like that. So there's always someone taking. But when one's young, then they're taking, you know, the major portion of this, or all of this. But when one comes into maturity, then most of it stays with oneself. And then a portion is going to the authorities. And then with the guru, then that's another thing. As the surrender is there, then that much is being transferred. But then that much is being purified also. If one doesn't surrender, one doesn't get purified. But as one surrenders, then those reactions are taken. Therefore, one is very grateful to all these people, because the parents, the teachers, the authorities, and the spiritual authorities, then they're all benefiting in so many ways. So because of that, then there's natural respect and service. Yes?
I did not clearly understand the last point about the reactions being taken as surrender.
See, it means the king takes the reactions according to how much tax he takes. You have a king. See, the maximum he can take is a quarter, and the minimum he'll take is a sixth. So between a sixth and a quarter, depending upon, you know, how much, you know, if it's a very good year, he may take more. Or if there's a great need in the kingdom, he may take more. But otherwise, it's a normal thing to take a sixth. Right? Of whatever. Let's say you grow a crop, you grow grains. So 1/6 of the crop is given in tax to the king. And then with that, then the king does all his works, you know, maintaining the kingdom, roads, water, protection, maintains the armies, all these things he does with that tax. So, because he's taken that tax, so he's taken a sixth, he takes one sixth of the bad qualities of whoever's given the tax. Right? He takes one sixth. If he takes a quarter, he takes one quarter of the bad qualities. And it's said if he takes the tax but doesn't protect, then he takes 100% of the bad qualities. He gets all the bad qualities of the person paying tax. In other words, what is surrendered, that much is what is given. Right? So if you're working without fruit, right, then it's the surrender. Someone who's working for fruit, for him to surrender means he surrenders part of the fruit. He doesn't surrender himself. He surrenders what's valuable. So if you surrender yourself, then to that degree we're surrendering, to that degree things are going. Like that. Someone has to understand the science. Then one sees that the Western concept of just be in control, that's the important thing. But along with that comes a little bit of, there's something that comes with it. Nothing's for free. The Western idea is everything's for free. You know? Or at least I can get it, you know, what is it? Enjoy now, pay later, right? Buy now, pay later, and get it on credit. You know? But it doesn't work like that. The Vedic thing, because there's so many, it means the bureaucracy is very expertly run. You know, there's no bottlenecks in the universal bureaucracy. You know, it's like, what you're doing is seen very easily. It means the sun sees, the moon sees, the wind sees, the 10 directions see, water sees, fire sees, you know. Like this, they all see, I think even the earth sees. So like that, then Yamaraj and whoever is controlling it, the different persons who need to know, everything's known to them. Because they get all their information from these people. So therefore, if we just want to take over and control something, then we have to also understand that those who are under us, then if we're not protecting them, but we're asking them to do what we say, we take on all their bad qualities. And if we protect them, then we only take a portion. You understand? So therefore, maturity is required if one is going to lead. That's why the Vedic system was so careful about the training of their younger generations. Because if the boys aren't trained properly, they can't lead. The girls aren't trained properly, there's the next generation after that's a flop. Because the first guru for the child is the mother, and if the mother is a terrible guru, then you get a terrible child. So the Vedic culture is very concerned about the training of the future generations. Means the whole thrust of the culture is that. Is training. And not only that, is once they're adults, their training still goes on. Once one becomes an adult, one's training doesn't stop. It continues. It may get somewhat, you know, it has to go on alongside with one's occupational duties. But then in the Vedic culture, then you get to the point of vanaprastha sannyas like this, and then it reverts right back to just studying and teaching. Because brahmacharya is studying only. Then when they get vanaprastha sannyas, means they're studying and teaching. Because they have a life of experience. Like that. So this is the... One has to understand is that the Vedic culture is very well thought out. Because it's thought out by Krishna. And no one's more thoughtful than him. So these things, they fit. Everything fits perfectly, but one has to know why. So someone just follows them, okay, that's nice. But still, if you don't know why, the benefit's very small. And if one rejects them out of not knowing why, then he gets less benefit than that. The smartest who follow gets some benefit. Those who reject and don't follow then get no benefit. But someone who understands and follows then gets great benefit. So that's what Krishna recommends. Perform prescribed duties in knowledge. So you should know what you're doing, why you're doing it, what's the purpose, how to do it.
So that principle applies for any point of person giving help to someone else.
Also, yes.
It's not just king or a spiritual master.
Means it specifically. Means yeah. Those, because it's point like this. It's like in the family. You have the father. Now the oldest brother is treated just like the father. Right? The father you speak to in respectful terms. Means in the Indian languages, you have three divisions. You have endings that show that you're either talking to someone superior to yourself, equal to yourself, or junior to yourself. Like that. In the West, sometimes some of the languages have superior and equal, but not junior. Like that. But in India, you have all three. So then, for the father, you speak senior to you. The older brother, especially the oldest, but any of the older brothers, specifically the oldest, it's also in the same language you'd use for the father. And then the other brothers, you use equal or junior, like this. It's just your friends. One may be a little older, one may be a little younger. But they're all friendly. But the oldest one is as good as the father. It's not the father, but he's as good as the father. Because the father's not there, he's the one that takes responsibility. Like that. So this principle of respecting. So if when he becomes in the position like the father, then he's the one that's taking. You understand? So the point is when there's surrender, there must be shelter. They go together. You can't separate surrender and shelter. When someone surrenders, there must be shelter. That's why a kshatriya, as long as there's a fight, he'll fight to the end. But as soon as the other person surrenders, the fight stops. He's surrendered. He gives shelter. You know? So you won't have this thing where a warrior, the opposite, you know, party, they're fighting and then they surrender and then the victorious side decides to kill them all anyway because they don't have enough rations or this or that to feed them and they'll be a burden. You don't get that. Then they're treated, they're given facility like whatever you'd give your own men. You may be careful with them, but they're given facility. So the Vedic culture is a very different concept. Like that. The whole point is you're trying to deal this thing of surrender and shelter. Is this important now? Navadvip, is this important now? I know you're talking to him, but I'm also talking to him. Right? And I got time from 5 till 6:30 to talk to him. So you can talk to him before that or after that. Right? Unless it's very important. The moon won't rise, or you know, the tides won't happen. Huh?
I can't
film
the map.
So then, why don't you ask him to go outside with you, and then you can tell him outside instead of you talking to him and me talking to him. Right? Understand? You still have to tell him. You just the two of you go outside, talk, and when you're finished, then you can come back. You understand? You don't understand. Yeah, it means there's an etiquette. When a class is going on, then, you know, the teacher speaks there. You want to speak to him, you ask me if you can speak to him, because I'm already speaking to him. Right? See, the thing is, if we don't think that what the teacher's saying is so important, then we just think we can talk, we can do anything, come, go, everything what we like. You know, so that may be a modern concept and well accepted around the world. But the idea is if two people are talking, you can't just come up and start talking to one of them and completely ignore the other one. You have to at least come and say, excuse me, you know, and then they'll recognize you and then you say, I have something important, I have to tell them now, I'm going somewhere. And then they'll say, okay, tell. Right? You understand? It means it's not just that, you know, I have nothing to do, and so I looked around for a job, and I found this one, and I get paid for it, and, you know, and I'm going to talk whether they listen or not, and I'll get paid as long as I keep talking, like that. I'm a teacher, he's a nice student, and it's, you know, in the relationship, it's my business to train him. So if you want to, you know, how you say, deal with him, you have to do so without disturbing the relationship, right? Vedic education is based on relationship. Modern is, you go to the school because if you don't, then the truant officer will come and catch you, you know, like that. And the teacher's there because he gets paid. And there's a few students who want to learn and a few teachers who want to teach. You're already disturbing the class anyway. You know, you lean across and I can't see Kontea. You're talking to him, he can't listen to me. Right? So it would have been easier for you to just take him out of the class than it would have been to just kind of, especially right in the front. So that means I'm seeing you talk to him, and you know, the train of thought needs concentration. And if it's disturbed, then it doesn't get anywhere. So if you have more to say to him, then you can both go outside and discuss. And if you're finished, then, you know, you've done your job.
Okay.
Okay, now here's another important point, is now in eating. So it says here that a twice-born man, he'll always eat his food with concentrated mind after cleaning himself, means washing the hands, the mouth, the feet. And then after he has eaten, then he will properly clean himself with water and perform achman. So cleanliness is very important, and concentration, because when you concentrate on the food, then the food actually becomes part of you. You're not concentrating, then it may not. Digestion is not as good. It doesn't really become part of you. You know? We see the, then it becomes like us. The whole process. We were conceived by thought. You know? And so we maintain this body by thought also. So it's an important principle. So cleanliness before eating, cleanliness after eating. Then it says, the next point is, it says the one should always respect the food. Whatever you're getting, you should eat it. It says eat it without contempt. You know, thinking, oh, this again, you know, like that. Then when you see it, then one is very happy. Not happy because your senses will be satisfied, or happy that the stomach will be filled. Is that the Lord has sent. This is what the Lord has given us. The Lord has kindly given us this to eat. So, and that, and whatever it is, we're happy with it. You know, if it's like, oh, this or that, or, you know, why this or why that, then eating that, it'll have a toxic effect on the system. One can't concentrate, as we mentioned before. Two, the thoughts are now not pure. And one has a bad feeling towards the prasad. Now, it's understood that if we discuss that the Vedic culture is all based on relationship, then when there's a good relationship between us and another person, then that relationship bears fruit. You know, it's pleasant. Everybody is very happy, satisfied. Everything moves forward very nicely. Both parties are very enthusiastic, and whatever is the relationship, it will grow. But if one person feels bad and the other one is complaining about them, then how will the relationship grow? You know, if the person is standing there and I'm criticizing them for no real good reason, it's not my position, then that other person will relate very nice with you and just smile and say, oh, great, thank you very much. And no, It won't work like that. So we have prashadam, and if we're criticizing prashadam, how prashadam is going to relate with us, reciprocate with us? It's not that Krishna as prashadam has to nourish us. It's not that Krishna is the fire of digestion. He does not have to digest what you put in the stomach. Out of his kindness, he does that. But if he doesn't want to, he doesn't. Otherwise, if he was forced, he had to do it, then how is it that there's so many people on the planet making big money off of digestive medicines? Right? Because either attitude is wrong, or, we overeat, we eat the wrong things, you know, that's not supposed to be what we eat. Eat them at the wrong times, wrong conditions. And so therefore, Krishna also reciprocates in the same way. Krishna is a person. Right? He comes as prashadam. And as prashadam, we have to properly respect the deal. Sit properly, eat properly, you know, receive the prashad properly, someone is serving it properly, someone's cooking it properly, someone's making the arrangements properly. And then everything's proper. Everything's perfect. You know, so we sit down and, you know, Mahaprasada ki jai, haribo, you know, I mean, this is the part of it. But it should be meant. We should understand what we're saying. Or we should understand what it means. Mahaprasada govinde nama brahmani vaishnave. Mahaprasad, the Lord, the brahmanas, the spiritual master, means one who understands their transcendental position, then is purified. And one who doesn't, one who has less piety, goes to hell. Very simple mantra. Then we discuss, this body is a network of paths leading to death. Right? Because the material energy, body is made of material energy. It's not. It's only alive because the soul's there. The body is destined to die. So we become absorbed in this body, and that absorption starts from the tongue. You talk nonsense, the mind becomes disturbed. We become angry. We eat. We don't control the tongue. The stomach becomes disturbed. The genital becomes disturbed. So everything starts from the tongue. You control the tongue, you control material life. So prashadam has come to control the tongue. How wonderful a thing. So that attention must be given. Proper attention. So in the Vedic culture, you see so much attention is given to prashadam. Chaitanya Charitamrita, about a third of what is there in the book, is dedicated to prashadam. Maybe not a third, but a huge amount. You know, you don't hear much about Lord Chaitanya taking his bath. You just know he went to the ocean and took his bath. You know, all the devotees, then they finished the morning kirtan, they all went to take their baths. Right? And so many different things are just dealt with. Like, philosophy is very deep. The relationship between devotees are very deep and explained very nicely. Preaching activities are shown very deeply. And taking prasadam is shown very deeply. I mean, the whole meal that Lord Chaitanya eats at Advaitacharya's house or these different places, the whole meal, preparation by preparation, how it was served, what was being spoken, what was the atmosphere, what was the relationships, what was done before the meal, during the meal, after the meal. You know, it even describes Advaitacharya that when he was cooking, when he finished cooking, his kitchen would be clean. The pots would be cleaned as they're doing. You use one pot, you're finished, you wash it. You put the next preparation on, while that's on cooking, you wash the pots. You cut some sabji, you clean that counter. Then you have to cut something else, when you finish that, you clean. So when he finished, the last preparation was finished, the kitchen was sparkling clean. It even goes as far to describe that. So the whole because cooking and serving and that is very much part of the Vaishnava culture and Brahminical culture. So Chaitanya Charitamrita spares no detail in describing these things. And that many times, not just once. You see also Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Bhogartik song. He gets right into detail what they did. They came, they washed up, they sat in lines, and they were served nice prasad, Rohini Mataji served, and all that, you know, like that. And then after that, then they got up, they washed, and then the prasad was distributed. You know, Krishna sat down, took some rest. So all this is going on. It's all described there in that song. The atmosphere, nice mood, everybody's happy. You know, happy to be there, happy to eat, happy with the association. It's all described. And this is all showing the principle of how Krishna's bhakti-vatsala. Very, very kind to the devotees. So he's kind, he comes as prasad. Krishna Boradoya Moy. Krishna is a great merciful, greatly merciful. He is Doyamoy, so he is Borodoyamoy. He's very, very merciful. So he's given us this prasad. So like that, the training is as a brahmachari to see like that. Otherwise, before that, it's just, you know, mother gives this, mother gives that, he likes this, doesn't like that, you know. But when he comes of a little maturity, then that all stops. All this nonsense that spoils you stops. Kid likes this, doesn't like that, does this, wants to do this, doesn't want to do that. All that stops. Now he learns how to be mature. So in this maturity, then he sees, now whatever you're given, that is what you are happy with. This is what Krishna has given you. So they would go out begging. What they beg, that's what they got. They don't have something else. Right? You go out and you beg and you get a potato, you can't expect you're going to have a cauliflower salad. You know, you beg the potato, you get a potato. You know, I mean, that's what you get. Right? So it's a very simple, it's a very important point. It says here that in his rejoicing, he should always have a pleased face, you know, be looking, and he should all, and he prays that he may always obtain the Lord's mercy. Like that. Then it says here, food that is always worshipped, respected, gives strength and vigor, but eaten irreverently, it destroys them both. So one's strength and one's, how you say, vigor. In other words, the health, and one's, you know, determination, all these things, if you take prasadam nicely, reverentially, it gains that. If it's eaten irreverentially, complaining this and that, it destroys them both. Health, everything goes. Then as a brahmachari, he should not give to any man what he leaves. And he should not eat between the two meals. Means remnants from your plate you shouldn't give to anybody. You know, I mean, if you've got a close friend, this and that. But one should not allow someone to take your remnants. The brahmacharis are very careful about that. They don't allow. The grihastha then, you know, his wife can take his remnants or like that. The children may take, but like otherwise. But the brahmachari, then nobody takes. You know, friends, sometimes you share something. You got this sweet, they want that. You say, that's another thing. That's not some remnants so much. You just... That's just the relationship. But you don't let anyone take the remnants like that. And it says one should not eat between the meal times. It means whenever your meals are, don't be snacking in between and hiding things and keeping things and stashing things and all that. Lord Chaitanya got upset. Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda both got upset with their servants because they had stored things. So this whole idea of storing, you get some and then you keep it for later. That aspect, or just getting things in between meals. You learn to just regulate so that at the meal times, that's when you eat. Otherwise, you eat between, you also destroy the health. Like that. And the control of the senses is not as strong. Then it says, you should not overeat. And it says, and nor should one go anywhere without having purified oneself after eating. It means go wash the hands, the mouth, the feet. Then one eats, then one washes, and then he can go here and there wherever he likes. But he should not just go off here and there for different work or business without purifying himself. It says, next point he makes is excessive eating is very bad for the health, is bad for fame, and for advancing. One cannot elevate oneself when overeats. Then it prevents the acquisition of spiritual merit, and is considered, you know, improper culture in the society. So one should be very careful to absorb it. I mean, to avoid overeating. Feasts are another thing. Then we see Bhaktivinoda Akanta Bhojan. Big feasts and these kind of like fun holidays. How much you can eat, that's all right. You know, Akanta. Kanta is the neck beads are called Kantimala because they sit on the Kanta. The Kanta is this bone here, just at this part of the neck where the collarbone meets the breastbone at the very top. There's a little U shape there. That bone is called the Kanta. So the neck beads sit on that. They touch that, so they're called Kantimala. So then Bhaktivinoda says, Akanta Bhojan, up to the Kanta. So, you know, that gives you, you know, yeah, it gives you, you know, nearly a foot between the stomach and that. So that's a bit extra. It means the stomach is well filled with some extra. That's there, because it's prasad. But as a normal thing, one should try to regulate the eating so one doesn't overeat like that. But overeating means more than you can digest. You're doing a lot of work, you're very big physically, you eat more. Someone who's doing less work or very, you know, not very strong, they eat less, you know. Children, if they're growing, they eat more. They're not, they're like this. So it's how much you can digest and the health is being maintained. If you eat more than that, then you start getting sick, that's overeating. Then it says that, so it mentions that one should also performing achman, because that's after eating, that it should always be sipped out of the Brahmarandra, out of this place at the wrist, where the palm meets the wrist, like that. You know, and it should never be, yeah, like that. You avoid, because the different parts of the hand are for different purposes. Out of the wrist, then, is for, how you say, is for, how you say, Brahman, like that. Then at the right hand, means at the side out near the little finger, and that is for Prajapati. Then out of the at the place at the front where the fingers are, that's for the demigods. But the place between the thumb and the index finger, that is for the pitas, you know, the forefathers and that. So one never sips out of that place like that. One never sips achman out of the place meant for the forefathers, you know, because then that is for worship of them. So it carries with it some of the taint of the mode of ignorance. So a Brahmin should never sip water from there. Should always sip it for the purpose of higher elevation. So that should be out of the where the palm meets the wrist. Then it says here that one should perform achman, sipping water 3 times, then wiping the mouth, and then touching all the different parts. So that's there in the full achman. In the full achman, the visesha achman, then the 24 names of Vishnu are used. So if one is doing, you know, yeah. So that is, you know, completely purifying, sipping the water, cleaning the face, and then doing nyas with the Lord's mantra on the whole body. Okay, and then it says performing of achman should be done with water that is not hot, nor has bubbles in it, because bubbles mean that the water is going bad. You know, I mean this means water bubbles that are generated from the water itself. It means if you have water and it's clean water and you let it sit for some time, then it starts to get bubbles. like that. If it's sacred water, then even it sits, it doesn't get bubbles. Like Ganga water and the other water will not get, Tirtha water will not get bubbles in it. So it means water that has developed bubbles on its own, like that. And then, of course, we're not generally using, you know, I'd say, aerated water for performing achman, like that. Then when one performs achman, one should not be distracted. And if one can, one should face east or north, like that. And if one's inside and one's worshipping the deity, one takes the deity as east. One's in a room where there is no deity or any specific auspicious element, then one does these things according to direction. But if you're sitting in front of the deity, you face the deity, you take them as east. East, the importance of it is that is the side that the sun comes, so light, enlightenment comes from that. North, knowledge comes. So from the Lord we're getting all this, the realization and the knowledge, everything's coming from the Lord. So he is east. The sun rises there, where the sun, Lord is. Then for sipping, then while sipping, it should reach the, while you sip the water, enough water should be put into the palm and sip that for a Brahmin it reaches the heart. Then he is purified. Kshatriya, the throat. Vaishya, the palate. Shudra, the mouth. The lips. Okay, then if one is worshipping the higher personalities, means you're worshipping the Lord, or for those who worship the demigods, then you wear the Brahma thread. It sits on the left shoulder and passes under the right arm. If you're worshipping humans, it's hung around the neck. And if you're worshipping the ghosts, then it sits on the right shoulder and passes under the left arm. So if it's this way, it's called upavin. If it's around the neck, I think it's nivin. Yeah, let's see.
Around the neck, forward and nivin?
People. Like you're worshipping a king or something like that. It means that's your deity. It means people in the mode of passion. And then those in the mode of ignorance, worship, you know, ghosts and other lower, and they wear it the opposite way. It was very interesting. I remember, I forget which group. One branch, break off branch, maybe the Hari Bowls or something, because they wanted to do everything different from the devotees. So they wore their Brahma thread backwards. They didn't know that that was a sign of someone who does ghost worship. Like that. Many times you see when they do worship of the forefathers, they hang the thread around their neck. And then they do all the worship like that. And then when they finish, they put it on the regular way. Yeah, nivitin means upavin. If it's on the left arm, then pakshinavin, if it's on the right arm, and nivin. No, prakshi. Then it says here the sacred thread, his water pot, his staff, any of these religious items, personal items, when they've been damaged and they're thrown into water. And then one receives new ones by chanting the proper mantras. Then here we said in the hair cutting ceremony, this is the second one, Keshanta. That's obtained for the Brahmin in his 15th year, Kshatriya in the 22nd, Vaishya in the 21st and 20th. It's the same as the other. It means that these are the times when they become mature. It's the interesting thing here is it's interesting to note that the same time is when that's the last possible point at which you can receive the upanayanam for the, you know, for those, yeah, the twice born, then it's also the point when they do the second cutting of the hair. So this cutting of the hair ceremony, then that is to, for the Brahman, the Brahmachari living in the Gurukul, it is for, like, it's, you've taken these vows to perform all these activities and Brahmacharya and all that when one's young, and follow properly the Vedic culture. So at that time, you kind of, you have an idea of what it is, but it's more intellectual. But at this point, then one becomes mature, and it's done again, like that. You can also do, I think other Dharma Shastras say, everybody can do it at the age of 16. So this age, then that's the time when one commits oneself, that one understands why he's doing these things, and is going to do this because he understands and wants to do them, rather than just it's he's supposed to do them. But now he wants to follow them. So the second hair-cutting ceremony is for that purpose. It's like a reiteration of the vows, now in a more serious fashion. One understands what is going on, why one's doing it. Okay, then it mentions that the girls also will go through the ceremonies, but without the recitation of mantra. Means just the particular rituals are done. The sprinkling of the water, the different aspects they're doing, the feeding with the anaprasana, all these different things are done, but without the mantras. And then the marriage ceremony, then it does all the activities of these samskars that are done for the boys. The marriage rite itself, the girl gets the same benefit as the boy did from upanayanam. Means whatever the boy did from taking the upanayanam ceremony, the girl gets the same benefit by the marriage ceremony. Then it says that, then in the service in the house, serving the husband is equivalent to the brahmachari living in the house of the teacher and serving the teacher. And the household duties, one gets the same benefit as the daily worship of the sacred fire. So by performing the brahmacharis perform the Agnihotra every day. So the wife gets that by performing the household duties. And by serving the husband, she gets all the same benefit that one would get by serving the guru. So we can see that this has been well related, is that the Vedic culture is very much keen on seeing that there is, you know, in the modern terminology, equal opportunity for the men and the women, but they have different mediums through which to get it because their nature is different. One will say opportunity is equal when nature is the same, right? But if the nature is different, one has to give that equal opportunity through that nature so that it will be fully taken care of, fully satisfied. So in this way, that the whatever benefits the boy would get, the girl will also get the same exact benefits, but through a slightly different process, like that. Then so this is the rules for the upanayanam, the Vedic initiation. So now after initiation, then how they must apply themselves. So now the first thing is that the teacher must instruct the student in the rules of personal cleanliness, how to keep oneself very clean, one's clothes clean, the place where one lives clean, you know, just one has to understand the difference between cleanliness and purity. Clean means is you don't see any dirt. purity means it's uncontaminated. So there, one has to understand the difference between the two and how to maintain them both. So that has to be done. Then how to perform the worship of the fire, or how to perform deity worship, and how to perform the chanting of the mantras, the Gayatri mantras. Then one shall, then before study, one will perform achman. While he's wearing clean cloth, one should be properly dressed. And, you know, one's system is properly in control. One should not come to the class having to, you know, go to the bathroom or, you know, feeling sick or these kind of things. In other words, the body is in control, the senses are in control, then one can concentrate on the class. Otherwise, then one will not be able to concentrate properly. Then there must be respect offered to the teacher. There must be obeisances offered to the spiritual master before and at the beginning and at the end of the lessons. They're saying in offering obeisances that one is touching the left hand, left foot, the right foot of the spiritual master or the teacher with the left hand, and the here it's saying, I think he's got it backwards. He's got the right hand with the right foot and the left hand. But generally it's crossed. The right foot is touched with the... Oh, no, yeah, that's right. The right foot is touched with the right hand. The left foot is touched with the left hand. It means the hands cross. So this is accomplished by putting one hand on top of each other. If the palms are flat, or if you're putting the palms together, then the thumbs are crossed. This is done by this process. Okay. So then the teacher here then will say, now we begin the study. And then when the teacher says to stop, then they stop. They don't continue. Then we always pronounce Om or Hare Krishna at the beginning of a lesson. So unless that, yeah, and then one always says it at the end. So this is called Sampat. When you have Om or Hare Krishna at the beginning of the lesson and at the end, then it becomes like sandwiched in the middle. So what this does is at the beginning, then if it's in the beginning, he will not be able to understand or grasp what is being taught. And if he doesn't say it in the end, it'll just kind of like he'll forget it. It'll fade away. So always before and end, then you always see that there's something. Some kirtan in the beginning, then there's a class, and then something at the end. Some Hari Bol, some Hare Krishna. Like that. There must be something. Otherwise, then it will be lost. Yeah. So one should be sitting properly and with mind concentrated. It says here that from the essence of the Vedas then came the three syllables AU and M, which is Om, and Bhur Bhuvah Svah. And then from that comes the Gayatri. So then this Gayatri then is chanted. By chanting very nicely the Brahma Gayatri, one gains the benefit of having studied all the Vedas. It says that one chants very nicely 3,000 times. So that means 3,000 times the Brahma Gayatri. That's a lot of Gayatris. Then after a month, then whatever kinds of, you know, how you say, great guilt and that is there from just past sinful activities, then that will be freed. And if the someone who has been initiated into the Gayatri does not chant it, then their position amongst those who are virtuous is lost. Yeah. So the purpose of this Brahma Gayatri is it allows one to come to the platform of Brahman. So this is the portal of the Vedas, means how you get into the Veda. It's the gateway to understanding the spiritual subject matter. And it helps one come to the Brahman platform. It says here, if you, after chanting it for three years, then one will come to, then one will start to get a good understanding of this Brahman understanding. Interesting here. It says here that chanting of the Gayatri is better than the performing suppression pranayama. Because pranayama, then that is the best form of austerity. Because it purifies. Other austerities may or may not purify if you're not concentrated. But the pranayama, it purifies because it steadies the mind. When the mind is steadied, then you can concentrate. So it's considered best of the austerities. It says, but better than that is chanting the Gayatri. In other words, in chanting the holy name. Because it says truthfulness is better than silence. So chanting the Lord's name, that is sat. So sat is always better than silence, better than nothing. Yeah. So then the syllable Om is none different from Brahman, and it is the, as Prabhupada explains, is the impersonal feature of the Lord. It means the A, U, and M. A stands for Krishna, U stands for the internal potency, and M stands for the living entities. But the form of it is impersonal. It means it doesn't have the personal manifestation. But it's made up of these elements. So even when we talk about Brahman, still there's ultimately no impersonal aspect, because Krishna is there, his energies are there, living entities are there. But the relationship is not manifest here. The living entities in the Brahman platform have not established their relationship with the Lord. But the Lord is there, his energies are there, and the living entities are there. So it says here, an offering consisting of muttering prayers, in other words, chanting the Gayatri, or chanting the holy name, is 10 times more efficacious or beneficial than a sacrifice performed according to the rules of the Veda. then it says, yeah. Muttered means very quietly. Basically, you're saying it with the mouth, but it can't really be, it's not audible. Like that. Then, 100 times more beneficial is when it's chanted inaudible, means in the mind. Oh no, here it's saying, if you chant it out loud, it's 10 times. Okay. If it's, you know, quietly but out loud. If it's inaudible, it's 100 times. And if it's mental, it's 1,000 times. And then Haridas Thakur says, then if you chant it at the top of your lungs, then it's even more beneficial than that. So this is the Gayatri, so it can't be chanted out loud. And the holy name can, therefore it's even more beneficial than the Gayatri mantra. Now what's interesting to note here is this is the, you get 10 times the benefit of a Vedic sacrifice. So by chanting the holy names, the Gayatris and even more the Maha Mantra, get all the benefits of performing these rituals, these Vedic sacrifices, and that one already gets. So therefore Haridas Thakur was so much glorifying the chanting of the holy name. That's mentioned here, but one will notice that very few people notice these verses. This is the point when all the Krishna says that it's only by the Veda that he's to be known, and all the acharyas point out that in the Vedas it's only talking about Krishna and the process of devotional service, but it's not so direct. Here it's very obviously pointed out that if you chant very nicely the holy name in the form of the Gayatri or in the Lord's holy names, you get more benefit than performing the Vedic sacrifices. Right? It's clearly said here, but most won't notice that, because this is all in connection with Brahman. So most people who are very absorbed in the Dharma Shastras are more interested in the fruit. So therefore Krishna is saying, perform the activities, the prescribed duties, but not for the fruit, only for the purpose of coming to Krishna. Then one gets the actual benefit. So here this point is being made that by chanting the holy name, you get more benefit than performing all the Vedic sacrifices. Therefore, in this age, we see we just chant the holy name. It's the most beneficial of all the things. Of all the different activities, the most beneficial. So it's being pointed out here. But even though it's been pointed out, Vyasadeva was unsatisfied, because it's not clear. So he wrote Srimad Bhagavatam to that very clearly say these essential points. Any questions on these? Well, there's two more verses on this point. It says, the four Paka Yagyas and those sacrifices which are enjoined by the rules of the Veda are altogether not equal in value to 1/16th part of the sacrifice consisting of muttered prayers. Means chanting of the Gayatris. But undoubtedly a Brahman reaches the highest goal by muttering prayers only, whether he perform other rites or neglects them. He who befriends all creatures is declared to be a true Brahmana. So by chanting the Lord's holy name and by, says here, befriending all creatures, in other words, associating with the Vaishnavas, respecting those who are senior, working nicely with those who are equals, compassionate to those who are juniors, and then is very, you know, well behaved with the inquisitive, the non-devotees, and never badly behaves with any living entity. Then such a person, then he is, says here, he is to be understood to be a true Brahman. So we see that is the devotee. Only the devotee actually comes to this platform. We see this topmost Brahman. So by we see that so many times in the Bhagavatam is brought out that one attains perfection by chanting the Lord's holy name, worshipping the Lord, and by befriending all living entities. It's always brought out. When there's no question of perfecting oneself if one just chants or worships the Lord but neglects all the other living entities. One doesn't behave properly with them, the one will never become perfect. There's many, many verses in Bhagavatam that bring this point out. When it asks, how did you attain perfection, or the person, the devotee, is talking about how he attained perfection, this point is always made. This aspect about dealing properly with all other living entities. It's always made. Yes.
Just one small point from the start of the class. You said about the earth protects chastity. I didn't understand how that relationship works.
She's the mother. Earth is the mother. So that potency, so the mother is very chaste, so that potency of the earth then is imbued in the girdle of the brahmachari, and then that protects his chastity. Yes.
I have one question.
A little louder, please.
I have one question about Brahmagaya. Especially, we pray to Savitri in this.
No, Savitri is what it's called. You're praying to Savitur.
And he's a sun god.
Yes.
And we pray to sun goddess to Krishna.
Yes, Surya Narayan.
Yeah. But sometimes we can read in Srimad Bhagavatam Prabhupada that if that's to be Savitur, he's a demigod.
Just that aspect is there. Means, but we're worshipping the potency that is there, what he's imbued with. You can see it very nicely in the prayers of the residents of Jambudweep. Because they, different mandalas on the all the different dweepas in the, I think it's what, fifth canto. Then each one of them has a different deity that they're worshipping. But they're worshipping the Lord who has manifest in this form. So they're actually worshipping the Lord. But they're doing it through that medium of that particular personality. You know, like that. But they're seeing the Lord. Like the Lord, the Archamurti, he comes in the form, comes to us so we can see in the form of stone or metal or a picture or water. So then for them, they're seeing coming in the form of, you know, Agni or Brahma or the sun or, you know, different personalities like this. So to them, it's just their worshipable deity. But they're worshipping the Lord. Not worship, just like we're worshipping the deity, we're not worshipping a stone, we're worshipping Krishna. So when they're worshipping like that. So when we worship Surya and Narayan, we're worshipping Krishna, just in that form. We're not worshipping the demigod Surya. Right? The jiva who is in that position to do that work. We're worshipping the Supreme Lord, you know, his potency and his manifestation. He is lighting the universe. He is nourishing all the living entities. He is illuminating. He is like that. That is the... That's all. This one. Yeah, there is that story of that one, what was his name, Kalidas? Huh? Kalidas, Lord Chaitanya's Leela, where he would invite the devotees over, and he'd put down a leaf plate and then feed them with nice mangoes and everything like that. And then afterwards the plates would be thrown, either he would say he would throw the plate, and they would be thrown outside, or they may not want him to take the plate, they'd fold it up and throw it in the place with the garbage, and he'd wash their hands and take care of them, and you know, they'd rest, this, that, and then after when they leave and gone and all that, he'd go back to where the plates were and get them out and, you know, lick the mango things and the plates and everything like that. So from doing that, then we saw that Lord Chaitanya, he came to Puri. And when Lord Chaitanya was going into Jagannath Mandir, then he washes his feet before going. And as he was washing his feet, then Kalidas stuck his hands under the water that was coming off his feet and, you know, very quickly took the water a few times. I think he got to the third time and he was going again. Lord Chaitanya said, that's enough. You know? But Lord Chaitanya never allowed any other devotee to do that. Not one. He was the only devotee allowed to do it. And it was said it was because of his respect for respecting the remnants of the Vaishnavas that Lord Chaitanya allowed this. Otherwise, no other. Even Swarup Damodar was amazed. You know, he wouldn't let him or Rupa, nobody. Nobody got this opportunity. Like that. So, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, you know, beg, borrow, or steal. Means you don't want to upset. They didn't know it. So they weren't upset. The point is you don't want the person upset with you. Otherwise, that's, maybe you get benefit from the remnants, but then you get the opposite from them being displeased. So therefore, if it's like a known thing or there's no other, you can ask. Like that. But otherwise, if they don't know, it's just left and you get, then that's another thing. Main thing is you shouldn't displease. Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj, he was more clever than anyone. They would invite him and he would eat. If he got the idea that they were, he would leave no remnants. Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj would even eat the bay leaves and, you know, other things that you normally take off and put on the side of the plate. He would eat those also. So he'd leave no remnants. You know, so you have an empty plate. You know, so he would leave nothing like that. And Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj, if he thought someone was going to even try to lick the plate, he'd eat the plate. When he'd finish, he'd roll up the banana leaf, stick it in his mouth and eat it. So, these aspects are there. Means in, see, it's saying here, because it takes more concentration to chant in the mind. So therefore, if one can do that, one gets more benefit. But if by chanting in the mind, you're not going to concentrate, better to chant it, you know, quietly. And if still can't concentrate, then say it just a little bit audibly, just so you yourself are hearing. No one else can hear. But generally, the louder you have to chant it means more restless the mind is. And the more peaceful, then you can do it just in the mind itself. Like that. But that's for the Gayatris. For the holy name, then it applies the same way, but the most beneficial is very loud chanting. Because not only do we get benefit, but then all the living entities, you know, like here, so many bugs and bacteria, and I mean, they all get benefit. They're all purified. So the Lord is very pleased with that. So when you have one devotee chanting, then. Anything else? Or? Yes. Say loudly.
You said that you should chant the Gayatri Mantra, proper mentality.
Proper means in a purified state, concentrating on the mantra. It said one should hear it, one should concentrate and know the meaning. Best is one chants with the knowing what the mantra means. And one can break it up. I think it's recommended that the sages recommend that you divide the mantra, because it's always got three padas. So after each pada, you just momentarily stop. Not much, just a slight break. You know, just a moment, because what it does is then it catches the mind. Because otherwise, if it's just chanting through with no break, sometimes the mind just goes and it spaces out. So you break it between the padas. Because each pada has its meaning. Each pada is like complete in itself. Like that. And then you can also pause after the beach syllable. You have the beach syllable, and then, like that. And then it mentions that the brahmacharis, the sannyasis, means those who are not grihasthas. For the Brahma Gayatri, they can also break it after Bhurbhuvaswa. So in other words, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 breaks for the brahmachari sannyasis, and for the grihasthas 4. Because you need to be able to connect the Bhurbhuvaswa. Either that or there won't be so much concentration on it. It's just generally there'll be also more, how you say? Brahmacharis are in training, they don't have much responsibility. It's easy for them. Then generally you find the Vanaprastha sannyas like that, then they're retired, so then they'll get into this. Grihasthas have a tendency to do things more quickly. Like that. One should always remember that grihastha life is a stage before getting to the detached ashrams, vanaprastha, and that. The ideal is if one has purified oneself nicely in previous lifetimes, then in this lifetime one does not find the need to go through the grihastha ashram. So straight from, one can remain brahmachari, from brahmachari one just goes straight to vanaprastha sannyas. But if one finds that those attachments are still there in the heart, then one deals with them by perform, like Krishna says, you purify yourself by performing your conditioned nature in relationship to Krishna. So perform the prescribed duties without desire for the fruit. So if one sees what one's conditioned nature is, well, there's the varnas, but then also the ashrams. So if in the ashram we find we have the nature for the grihastha ashram, and we're not able to, that doesn't go, it stays on the mind, then one enters that, and then one performs those prescribed duties not desiring the fruit, and that purifies it. Then all those desires are finished. Then one is able to go on to these. Right? So someone who can follow that without going through grihastha life in this lifetime means they've already done that in the previous lifetime. So they've already been gone through. Everybody's going through it. It's just a matter of they did it this life, last life, you know, whenever. So like that. So it's a stage that one goes through. It's not a strong position that we identify with. Problem comes in the cultures we identify with it, then we run into problems. We think, well, I'm a grihastha, then how come these kind of discriminations? Or I'm a man or I'm a woman, why these discriminations? Or adult and a child, or leader and a follower. These are the conditioned natures. They can't be avoided. You know? So then, accordingly, we deal with them and perform the duties of those varnas and ashramas. Then, and we do it without desire for the fruit, then, one, there's no difference between any of them because they're all purifying and all situating yourself on transcendental platform. And two, whatever the position, yeah, they'll all purify. But if we identify with it and we want the fruit of it, then we can say, yes, this one's better, that one, or this or that. But otherwise, it doesn't matter. Because when you perform the duty without desire for the fruit, means you've given up the work that creates the fruit. You're performing the work, but you've given up the fruit before it's come. So that means you've given up fruitive work. And that's called sannyas. Right? Performing fruitive work and giving up the result, that's called renunciation. But giving up work that creates material fruit, that's called sannyas. So that doesn't matter what ashram or what varna you're following, if you're performing nishkam karma yoga like this, devotional service by performing prescribed duties without desire for results, it is sannyas. But we have to purify the conditioned nature. So then we're intelligent and see, okay, I can purify myself by the brahmacharya ashram. No, I have to purify myself by the grihastha ashram. Or I can purify myself by the vanaprastha or sannyas, depending upon the nature. Right? We don't mind collecting stuff. So therefore we should collect stuff for Krishna. We hate collecting stuff. Therefore we should follow the ashram that doesn't collect stuff. But we have to do that for Krishna. Otherwise then it just, we gain an aversion. And someone who has too much attachment or aversion, neither of them can become a good devotee. Because then things that are valuable for Krishna consciousness, if there's attachment, you'll use them for yourself. And if there's too much aversion, when the opportunity comes, you won't take it, and you won't use it in Krishna's service. So one, whatever one's position, the sannyas has to purify himself from aversion to material nature. And grihastha has to purify himself from attachment to material nature. You understand? So from the devotional platform, they don't really see any difference. One who can go through more simply, just from the brahmachari straight to sannyas, life's easier. But if not, grihastha ashram is a very, very recommended way to purify oneself. As long as one follows it in the path of purification. In other words, according to the duty. So that's what this is talking about. Means here, the instructions being given here by Bhrigu is for the purpose of one who wants to purify himself by following the prescribed duties. Means one who wants to follow the instructions of the Gita, here it's telling what does those prescribed duties mean. Krishna says, do your prescribed duties. So here is being described, what are those prescribed duties? Right? Krishna says in the Gita, I spoke this to the sun god, he spoke to Ikshvaku, and Ikshvaku spoke to Manu. So these are the rules of Manu. Right? So he said, in this way, then this science was handed down. So the science of knowing how to perform prescribed duties in the Lord's service, that was handed down. He spoke it to Vivasvan, to Ikshvaku, to Manu. Like this, it was handed down to the saintly kings. Then it was lost. Now he's speaking Gita to Krishna. So those things and this knowledge, they go together. This is a support. This is the details of what is the prescribed duty. You know, more important than understanding the prescribed duty is understanding how to work without desire for a result. That's the most important. That's what we want. In knowledge means we have to know what's going on. That makes sense. Like that. So, from the transcendental platform, there's no discrimination. Because anything used in Krishna's service is spiritual. And anything not used in Krishna's service is illusion. So it doesn't matter whether it's pious illusion or impious illusion. It's all illusion. You know, Prabhupada says gold chain or iron chain. It doesn't matter. You're still chained. So therefore, unless you use it in Krishna's service, you're chained to the material world. So we have to be very careful not to get caught up in this thing that piety is better, morality is better. No. Any engagement in Krishna's service is better. Someone who engages in Krishna's service naturally has all the qualities of the demigod, so therefore all these pious things that we look for are there. But they're there because of the spiritual. It's not that they make the spiritual happen. No, the spiritual makes them. Proper spiritual understanding makes for a proper moral platform, makes for proper engagement of the senses, makes for proper understanding of who we are. So the Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, these platforms only mean something in relationship to Krishna consciousness. Otherwise they have no meaning. On their own, we are not interested at all. But in Krishna consciousness, they're the culture. We follow them. You follow the Dharma, economic development is automatically there. We use that Krishna service. Facilities for the senses are there. We use them in Krishna service. You know? The coming to the platform of liberation is automatically there, but we use that in Krishna's service. I think Bhakti Srimaraj gave a class, I think it was yesterday, and he was talking about, you know, for the devotee, there's no interest in liberation as a goal. Liberation is just a step on the way back to Godhead. Like that. That's all. It's just part. It means coming to the Brahma-Bhuta platform means you have no material attachments and no material identification. So that's a step in Krishna. It's just, it comes. You chant Hare Krishna, you'll get there. It's not something that one is striving for. It just comes automatically. And when one gets there, one continues on past that to pure attachment to Krishna. Does that make sense? Add anything, Pontiaji? No? It's called Brahmanjali. It's mentioned here. Respect for the Veda. Joining his palms, that is called Brahmanjali. Joining the palms for the sake of the Veda. Yes. Okay, so we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.